We're at the Aging and Healthy Lifespan Conference at the Harvard Medical School with Cynthia Kenyon, who's Professor of Biochemistry and Biophysics at UC San Francisco and a founder of Elixir Pharmaceuticals. I've been asking a number of people the same question, which is that as I look and see on the newsstands right now a whole series of articles like this one, Can We Cure Aging? The Aging Cure. The implication from those two is that aging is disease. Is that your perspective on it?
Well, you know, it's kind of a semantic issue. Basically, people get older and decline, and a 90-year-old, normal, healthy 90-year-old, isn't capable of doing what a normal, healthy 45-year-old is doing. They're just not as strong, they're much more frail. So if they were 45 and looked 90, we would say they have the disease of progeria, of rapid aging, which is considered to be a disease. But because they're the age that we expect this to, mm-hmm. we expect them to look that way for their age, and it happens to everyone, we don't think of it as a disease, really. But you could think of it as a disease.
Okay, so...
But it's a condition of decline that happens to everyone.
Right. Could you a sort of 101 guide to your research?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so we started out, my hypothesis was that there were genes in the DNA, genes, particular genes that affected aging. Genes that might be responsible for the different lifespans that different species have. So for example, rats get old and die in 3 years, whereas squirrels can live to be 25. So the idea is that the reason squirrels live longer is because they have particular gene changes. And maybe if you took one kind of animal, like a rat, you could make a change in a particular gene and get it to live the life, have a lifespan more like that of a squirrel, live a little longer, or maybe a lot longer. So we started doing that using a really simple little animal that's just about the size of a comma in a sentence, called C. elegans. It's a little roundworm. It lives in the soil and it's harmless. But the nice thing about it is it's really easy to manipulate the genes of this animal. And it's also good because it has a really short lifespan. It just lives a couple of weeks. So we just looked and asked, if we change particular genes, any genes, could we get a longer lifespan? And we were very lucky to find that if we change one particular gene, whose name is DAF2, then we double the lifespan of the worm. In one fell swoop, we created a whole race of worms, if you will, that were exactly the same as the normal worms except for one gene. And these worms live twice as long. It would be as though I could just snap my fingers and people started living to be 160, or looking 45 when they were 90. So that's the kind of change. It's something that you can't actually imagine. I mean, you could imagine it perhaps if you're very imaginative, but when you just see it, it's something that you think that it would be possible to be old and healthy, but you don't think that it would be possible to be both old and young at the same time. And that's
let's
what
clear,
happened.
But let's clear one thing out, which is that the whole notion of using model animals and then saying you can extend or extrapolate to human beings. We're talking about the worm, Cynorhabditis elegans, mm-hmm. which is the experimental animal that your advisor, mentor, Sydney Brenner, decided was a good thing to work on.
Yes.
Is that a reasonable thing to extrapolate? I mean, I assume that it's a model animal. It's precisely because you can
well,
do that.
Well, what I said was that in human terms, it would be, if I were a worm, then having a doubled lifespan would be the equivalent of a human living to be 160, being young at age 90. That wasn't to say that we could do the same thing in humans. Now, that's another question. Could we do the same thing in humans? The answer is, of course, you don't know until it could happen. You don't know until you do it. And maybe you can never do it. We don't know. But what we do know is that many processes, biological processes that take place in these little worms, happen in the same way throughout the animal kingdom, including in people. So the way the cells know when to divide, the way muscles are made, the way nerve cells are made, the way they're organized into an animal, the way an animal thinks that something is attractive and something else is repulsive, that's all done in a very, very similar way on the molecular level in these little worms as it is in humans, even though we look so different from one another, such different sizes. So you could, so basically what that tells us is that a lot of the basic biology of life evolved a long, long time ago in a precursor that gave rise both to the worm and the human. So when one of your great, great, great to the nth grandfathers, you know, was even simpler than a worm, do you see, at that time. So, so since we know so much else is conserved in similar between organisms, it is possible that aging mechanisms will be. And now there are experiments that suggest that that really is the case.
You were talking about inhibiting TOR, TOR, extends lifespan. These are sentences with alphabet soup and make no sense to whoever's watching this.
Yeah.
Can you sort of put them into some sort of a
yes, I can.
Story?
I can. So basically, I think an easy way to think about it is, first of all, it is possible to change any, now we know, any of a number of genes and get these little worms to live a lot longer and get them to stay young a lot longer. It's also possible to change a lot of genes in the fruit fly and get it to live longer and stay young longer. And the same is true of the mouse. It's possible to change many different genes in the mouse and get it to stay young a lot longer than it normally would. Okay, now, all these genes seem to have something in common with one another, which is that their normal functions in the animal tend to have something to do with nutrients, that is, with food, or with the response that an animal has to harsh environmental conditions, like stressful conditions, reactive oxygen species, hydrogen peroxide, UV light, temperature. And so basically, I think a kind of unifying concept, which is very helpful and I think true. I mean, it's hard to make, to be really, the field, we're still, there's still a lot of research going on, so it's premature to be too definite about anything. But it looks as though animals can be in two different physiological states. They can either be happy, you know, physiologically speaking. I don't mean mentally, but I mean physiologically, if they have a lot of food and, you know, everything is good. The animal tends to just eat the food, reproduce, get old, and die. But if conditions are tough, then what happens is animals, they switch on a lot of new genes that encode proteins that are protective, that make the cells kind of clean them up and protect them. So they'll, for example, they'll counteract reactive oxygen species. These new gene products will help proteins to fold correctly. They'll protect them from infections. There's all sorts of different things that they'll do. And you can shift between these two states by either possibly by, you know, by administering an environmental stress, for example, hunger, or by changing a gene that's involved in the normal response to that stress. And if you change one of these genes, then you get this more resilient physiology that seems to increase lifespan. And it's probably pretty simple. It probably increases lifespan because it kind of cleans up the mess in your body that accumulates with time.
Now, why would this apparently good move not be naturally occurring? Why would that not be built into this?
Yeah, nobody really knows that. That's a kind of evolutionary question. But you can imagine a lot of things. One thing you can imagine is if, let's look at my little worms. It's a nice example. It takes them 3 days to go from the fertilized egg to the adult. Very fast. In the next 3 days, they have 300 children. Okay, so let's look at this worm when it's 6 days old. It's now been an adult for 3 days, but it's produced 300 brand new worms. Okay, so now let's go another three or four, maybe another 6 days. All these 300 brand new worms have now produced 300. So now we have 100,000 worms present. And we have one, you know, like the centenarian with her family, except it's 100,000 of them. So that she would be by then only, I don't know, still a pretty young worm. So the question is, if a worm can generate all these brand new worms so quickly, what's the point of, you know, of building a worm that does the best it can to keep itself running for a long time, to clean up all the damage that accumulates with time? Why bother if you're just making brand new worms? So that's possible. That's possibly one of the, and you can think about it this way. What if you had two groups of worms? In one case, the worms have this these protective mechanisms on all the time, at full blast. So they're clean as can be, clean as whistles. They're still having these progeny, and the others don't. They just have the progeny, and then they die. Well, if it takes a little more food for the animal to maintain this crisp, clean state for a long time, then this population that has to eat a little more is going to run out of food faster than this one. So it's going to eventually have a disadvantage, potentially. So that's one possible reason. Another possible reason is that when these older animals, when they get old, they still eat food. They're still eating. So they're competing, actually, with their progeny. Mm-hmm. And these progeny, it turns out these worms are self-fertile. So they one worm makes both sperm and oocytes. So it fertilizes itself. So they're completely inbred. And by that I mean that the progeny has exactly the same DNA as the mother. Okay, so when you're competing with your progeny, you're competing with your own DNA, essentially. So why do that? So that's another possibility. It could be that, you know, that a population of worms that doesn't do that had an edge over one that did. There's another thing, though, that's actually very, very important, which is that lots of different animals have ways of hunkering down in the face of harsh environmental conditions. So, for example, caloric restriction, eating less food than you'd like to eat, extends lifespan in lots of different organisms, possibly primates as well. And it appears to do so by bringing out these protective influences. But that's one thing. But there's lots of organisms where food deprivation causes them to hibernate or become spores, you know, for smaller ones, to go into states of what are called diapause, which are kind of timeouts where they just suspend themselves. And often these states of suspension occur before the time of reproduction. So let's look at our little worm again. It hatches. It takes 3 days for the worm to become an adult. But what if the worm, after it hatches from an egg, what if it gets hungry? It turns out the worm doesn't. A child will just be a hungry child and grow to an adult, maybe a stunted one. But they'll grow or they'll eventually die of starvation. But not a worm. If the worm is hungry, what happens is it stops and it encloses itself in a protective case and it just waits. It's very inert. It doesn't eat, it doesn't reproduce, it just waits. And when food comes back, it can sense the food and it comes out of this state and becomes an adult. Now, in that state, it can live a really long time. And it turns out that particular state called the dower is characterized by the expression of many genes that can extend lifespan in ordinary adults. Okay, so they switch on all these protective genes. Now, and there's a whole little circuitry in the worm that governs the coordinated expression of these genes. And it involves some of the same genes I've been telling about that we found can extend the lifespan of adult animals. But the point is, this could have arisen in evolution because, so let's suppose you have this system. Now, the worm faces adversity. It flips a switch. On come the protective genes, and it hunkers down. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, food comes back, and it exits that stage, grows up, and it reproduces. And it reproduces under conditions where there's food for the progeny. Okay. Now you take those worms and you compare them to some worm that doesn't have this ability to take this time out. They just try to grow and then they starve to death. They can't take a time out. So you can see immediately why the ability to switch on a protective state can be advantageous to a species. Caloric restriction itself, actually, just ordinary caloric restriction like for a rat, which extends lifespan, also delays reproduction. And if you take a rat that's been calorically restricted long enough that its well-fed counterparts are all dead, and then you give it food, it can now reproduce. So you've allowed that rat, caloric restriction allows that rat, or the response to caloric restriction allows that rat to outlast an unfavorable environmental condition so that it can reproduce. So there are a lot of reasons to think that this system could evolve. There would have been pressure on it to evolve, to allow the organism, you know, to get by unfavorable environmental conditions without wanting it to express it all the time. It takes a little more energy to do that.
So in an adaptationist view, an evolutionary biological view, once you've achieved your fitness goals, not to be teleological about it, but once you've reproduced and increased your inclusive fitness. At that point, you know, sex starts death. Essentially, is the bald statement about that?
Well, it's so complicated. Yes, because you know you can think about the individual, but you can also think about the society. So, for example, humans have long lifespans, longer than we need to have children to get the children out of the house safely and happily. We still have a long lifespan. And if you look in societies, you see that the elders are contributing a lot in many different kinds of societies. They're often the leaders. They can be the ones who remember what to do if there's a certain kind of disease or something. In the tsunamis that happened in Indonesia a few years ago, people who had grandparents in the house had a much better chance of surviving because the grandparents remembered that when the sea goes out, you should run for the hills. So they did. They didn't need to go to the encyclopedia and look up what do you do when it wasn't written down. They just remembered it. And it was the elder people who, you know, that's a big deal, right? Their children could pass their genes on.
And indeed, so, as you know, there's the so-called grandmother hypothesis.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, yes. Yes.
Sarah Hurdy's work, of course.
Yes, yeah. Yes, okay. Yes, yes.
I just wanted to try and bring that out. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that Aubrey de Grey was saying earlier, I mean, it could be summarized as, you know, breathing will kill you. Ironically, that taking in pollutants, antioxidants, and so on and so forth, breathing is dangerous. So how does one navigate through all these conflicting tendencies? You mentioned one, which would be calorie restriction. This is advocated by some people as being a way of extending your life, right?
Well, I don't know. Most people that I know don't actually advocate it. They want to find mimetics, a drug that you could take so that you could eat your dinner and also your body would think that you were calorically restricted.
Well, there are a couple of people at the meeting today who are suggesting that calorie restriction and based on Rick Weindruck's work and so on and so forth,
yes,
it seems
yes.
to expand, mm-hmm. extend lifespan. I'm not asking you to endorse or suggest that everybody should do it, but you do to some extent, right?
I don't think I calorically restrict myself. I eat the pathway that we found affects aging influences the hormone insulin. What we found is that if you take the hormone insulin is one that's absolutely essential for every animal and people, and it allows your body to take up nutrients. So it's kind of a good life hormone, you know? You take up the nutrients that you eat. You eat a meal, the glucose or sugar comes out of the food into your blood, stimulates the production of insulin, and then that causes your biochemical pathways to be in what they call the fed state, which means after having had a meal, being well fed. So you know your food is absorbed by your tissues and it's utilized or stored as fat or glycogen. And it turns out that if you inhibit slightly the pathway, so it's still there, but it doesn't work quite as well, then you can extend lifespan by a huge amount, by a tenfold in these little worms. So instead of living an average of 20 days, they could live an average of 200 days. I mean, it's a big difference, which isn't to say that we could do that in humans, but you can get a very large large effect. And what happened was what normally regulates insulin levels in your body is sugar. And we took our little nematodes, which normally eat just bacteria, it's like the Atkins diet, and we gave them some sugar, and we found that what happened is they lived shorter because they had a more active insulin-like system. And so that made me decide to go onto a diet that had what's called a low glycemic index, which means that when you eat the food, the sugar in it, either there's not a lot of sugar in it, or if there is, it's released slowly into your blood. So this would be like
spike.
A South Beach diet or it's one of those kinds of diets. And so that's what I do, and I've done it since 2002. And I think it's great, but no one really knows. There have been studies done on these diets, and there are a lot of positive outcomes from it. And people who have type 2 diabetes are often told to keep the sugar level down. So I think that's what I do. I don't really think that I'm calorically restricted, but I'm not sure. Because when you eat a diet like this, you're actually not as hungry. So you end up, and the other thing is, if you live in the real world, which I do, a lot of times people will feed you something that's almost all carbohydrates, like our lunch today. Bag of potato chips, which I don't eat, a huge piece of bread with a few pieces of meat and lettuce and tomatoes, tiny. So I had to take the bread apart and I could just eat the little stuff. I mean, I could eat the whole thing, but I don't want to. And so I actually ended up not having a very big lunch. So, plus fat actually satiates your appetite. So when you eat a meal that has, it's lower in carbohydrates or sugars and starch, then you're eating a little more fat, proportionally, and so you probably just aren't as hungry. So that's what I do.
I read somewhere that you actually were looking at some results that you got and sort of went, oh.
Yes, that's what happened, exactly. So we fed our worms. So I was reading a paper about yeast, which is a single cell organism that people also use for studies of aging. And when people grow their yeast, they always add a little sugar, 2% glucose. And I was reading these papers, and when they calorically restrict the yeast, they go from 2%, you know, to 1% or to 0.5%. And I thought to myself, we give our worms 0% because we give them bacteria to eat. And so I thought, well, what would happen if we gave them a little sugar? And they actually lived shorter than normal. And then we had a mutant worm where we had changed a gene. And in this mutant, the change that we made in one of their genes had already locked them into a kind of full blast on insulin pathway. Okay, so the pathway was already locked on full. And so they live shorter. I told you that pathway decreases lifespan. You have to have some of it, but if you have too much, you have a shorter lifespan. And when we took those animals and we gave them sugar, they didn't live any shorter. And in fact, the glucose or the sugar made the normal worms have the lifespan that was characteristic of this other one. So, I mean, and insulin is known in humans to be activated by sugar. So I got those results and I thought, uh-oh. It works the other way too. You know, the worm is sort of set in between. It's not set at one extreme. It's set where the system is going a little bit. And if you lower it somewhat, you live longer. If you lower it a lot, you die. So be careful. If you lower it a little bit, you live longer. But if you raise it, now you live shorter, and glucose raises it. So that's why I switched. And I'm really happy with it. I love it. I think it's great. You feel like you have a lot of energy. It's easy to stay thin. You know, I think it's great. But at the same time, you know, it's not proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is a good idea, what I'm doing. Do you know? In fact, it's amazing how little we know about what you should eat. Actually, it's a little bit embarrassing, you know, given all the things we can do with computers and rocket ships and all that we don't exactly know if you should eat a bagel.
Well, that fits with one of the things I was mentioned to a couple of people early today, which is that, you know, as I look back, next year is the 350th anniversary of the Royal Society, its foundation, which is basically an instantiation of Francis Bacon's ideas of a community of scientists, community of scholars. And Bacon, of course, wrote all these wonderful books, including The New Atlantis. But he also wrote extensively on longevity in 1610, 1619, these books.
Read Shakespeare's sonnets. They're all about...
And here we are, 400 years on, still... saying, not sure what it is, don't really have theories of aging, maybe that's not relevant, we don't know whether we have a use-by date, we don't know whether we can extend lifespan indefinitely, we don't know whether actually caloric restriction really works or exactly why, and we have massive amounts of costs being incurred by people who are suffering from metabolic syndrome, which is what you're talking about here, the insulin issue, or the last year of life, which is probably means that they, you know, could have done something dietarily or in lifestyle-wise to have lived longer and exited in more dignified fashion, put it that way. Such confusions. I mean, how does one get some of this information across to the people who are informed to make decisions?
Yeah. So first question was a really good one, which is, you know, if we could live longer, why haven't we already figured out how to do it? You know? And I think because it's only in the last 20 years that we realized that you could change a gene and the animal would live twice as long. I mean, it's actually interesting. When we change a gene with these worms, I'm not going into that worm with, you know, a bunch of nails and a hammer and fixing all the organs. You know, I'm not. The worm is fixing its own organs. It's doing all the work. I just change one regulatory gene, and it has the intrinsic ability to live twice as long. It's built into the worm itself, the ability to live longer. We're just kind of tweaking it and bringing that out. And you could imagine if we could actually put extra copies of some of these genes into the worm, then maybe we could increase the lifespan even more. But even without doing that, just making a little change can get a big effect. But that wasn't known. Francis Bacon didn't know that.
Yes.
So if you look around, you'll see that some species live longer than people, like turtles, and some fish, and a redwood tree. So we know it's possible, but most people think of that, oh, isn't that interesting? But then they think, but I don't want to be a turtle or a redwood tree, you know? And they don't, so they don't want, they imagine in their own mind that perhaps that if we could live that long, you know, we wouldn't be human, we would be more like a turtle or a fish. So it would be a trade-off. But there's, I think the reason I think that is they didn't have a role model. If there were some primate, a monkey, that lived to be 500 years old, that played the piano, went to the opera, could do long division in their head, you know, and run around the block, we would have figured it out. If our dogs could do it and they looked at us, they would think, now how come my owner is the same age that he was when I was a puppy, you know? They'd be working on it by now. And I think now we have role models. We have these little animals, which they don't look like us, but they are like us. They have the same kinds of cells and tissues. They have a muscle, they have nerve cells, they have an intestine. They're built the way we are, but you can make them live a lot longer. So now I think we really have, we have role models. And not only do we have role models, we have actual evidence. So we found in our lab that when you inhibit a gene called DAF2, which encodes the receptor for this hormone insulin, the worms live twice as long. And to live long, what they do is they switch on and off a whole bunch of new genes in the DNA. And they do that because they activate another protein called DAF16. It has another name, FOXO, which is a protein that binds to the DNA that switches on and off various genes. So the simple point is that if you lower DAF2, the insulin receptor, you raise the activity of this other one, DAF16, and it binds to the DNA and turns on anti-aging genes. Now, humans have a DAF16 gene also. And it turns out that scientists have found that at least six populations of humans that they've studied, there's a correlation between certain forms of this gene and the ability to live to be 100. Which, what I'm telling you is very important. It says that the genes that we discovered have this huge effect on lifespan in these little worms also have an effect on lifespan in people. So we don't only need, we have role models. We have these worms that can stay young a lot longer. And I didn't mention this, but they're also resistant to all sorts of diseases, which is wonderful and kind of a big bonus. But anyway, the point is that humans have the same genes, and they also impact our aging. So we, now knowing that, I think it's unstoppable now. I think there's such promise here of being able to delay a whole bunch of age-related diseases and, you know, stay young and healthy longer. I think people want that, and I think that, you know, the genie is out of the bottle now.
What technically is required to do what you just said?
Well, we don't really know what our potential is. The worms, these little worms, we know have the potential to live at least 10 times as longer than they normally do, which is something hard to believe. I mean, I have pictures of these worms. I just showed a movie in the talk I gave today of worms that were 144 days old, moving around and looking youthful and carefree. It was amazing. So I don't know if we have that built-in potential. So what I said to you about the worms is you change one gene, all the other genes, all 20,000 of them, are normal genes. They're not changed, but they're capable of continuing to do their jobs for a lot longer than they would normally do their jobs. We don't know if that's the case with humans. If we change one gene, would all the other genes be capable of continuing? We don't know that because it hasn't happened. We have no idea. So we don't know what our intrinsic potential is for lifespan extension. The variants I told you about for this DAF16 or FOXO gene, they make you more likely to live to be 100. But if you have a variant, it's not an all or nothing effect. You're just a little more likely to live a little longer, you know? So we don't know yet. And actually, we had no idea in the worm, these little worms that we studied, we had no idea that before we changed that gene and doubled the lifespan, we had no idea that it would ever be possible. In fact, that's the thing. It's still hard to believe that it's possible. Even when you watch a movie of the old worms looking young, you know, looking like, I don't know, just young people would look. You can't imagine that it could be possible.
Right. So I'm.
So how would you do it? Is that what you're
saying?
Well,
not just that. Obviously, this and ethicists are thinking about
this. Oh, that's
this.
A whole other issue, which is very important.
They're obviously thinking about this. But first of all, given the system, how do you even get people to, how do you get that kind of trial done?
Well, I think the really, obviously, in a way, it's obvious when you think about it, but there are a lot of diseases that are more common as you get older, called the age-related diseases, like cancer, Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, all sorts of diseases. And when you delay aging, as it turns out, you delay the onset of these diseases. A lot of people didn't think that would be the case. They thought, well, look, if you could just live to be 90, well, then you'd automatically get Alzheimer's disease. Everyone, you would get it still at age 80 or 90, which is when most people get it now. But no, actually, if you're, what the animals are telling us is that if you're, say, biologically 45, when you're, by the calendar, you're 90, well, then you have another 45 years to go before you get Alzheimer's disease. It's like too much to be true. I mean, too good to be true. But it seems to be true, at least in these animals. So basically, what that means in practical terms, two things. Number one, it means that you could get a pill for aging approved, a drug for aging approved, without ever doing an aging trial, by just doing a trial for prevention of an age-related disease. And that's what's actually happening right now. Because there's no conduit, there's no political or channel for developing drugs that oppose aging. There may be in the future, but there isn't anything right now. And the other thing is that even without any, me or any other of us scientists studying aging, a pill like this might be developed if you know nothing about aging and you're just working on a disease, because the biological pathways that affect aging affect disease. So if you're tinkering around with disease pathways, you may very well hit one that affects all of aging. So if you do, you should know it, because you'll give the pill to someone and it will be effective against that disease, and then eventually you'll realize it's effective against this disease and this other disease and this other disease. And then you might even realize, if you give it to healthy people, that they're aging more slowly, or their pets will age more slowly and live longer. So you could figure it out, kind of go in the back door that way.
Right, it would be a back door, because as David Sinclair was saying earlier in a conversation, the amount of money that is officially given to basic aging research is infinitesimally small.
It's tiny, which is really bad, actually. Because this is brand new. It was 20 years ago, we didn't know this was possible. So we have a brand new field, really, the molecular biology of aging and the links between aging and age-related diseases. It's a new field. It's full of promise and potential, unimaginable potential. And, you know, since it's so new, every time you turn around, you make a new discovery. You go, oh my goodness, look at that. Look at this. It's like you're digging, you're an archaeologist, and you find an ancient city, and you're just walking down the streets, and you say, oh my gosh, look. Everything is new and wonderful. Whereas, you know, some of these other diseases, I think we're still making progress on, but we've been around a lot. So why not pour more money into this area and try to get some of this low-hanging fruit that might really be pretty easy to get? And, you know, now, of course, I have a conflict of interest, but that's going to be the case because I work on it, you know, so I will benefit from this money. But I really do think that it's pretty easy to see beyond that some kind of going after it's the risk factor, the biggest risk factor for all diseases, way bigger than smoking, you know, is aging. And if you can go after aging, you have, not all diseases, but many diseases, you could really make a lot of progress. And as you say, I mean, what if you could develop some kind of pill that would keep you really young and healthy for a long time, and then you would just die? And that's actually what happens in some of these long-lived animals. There's some long-lived mice where all the mice look great, and you think they're going to live forever. They live longer than the normal mice. They look great, and then they start dying, and you don't know what they've died of. So it's a mystery, but in a way it's kind of good, because if you had a population like that, you know, you could really save a lot on healthcare bills.
Well, but then, what, you know? Then? Because then, aren't you, I mean, if you're then stuck with a hugely increased and very slowly diminishing population.
Oh. Now this is, so what I'm talking about right now is, say, having everybody live to be 95, looking, let's say, at most 65, and then just dying in their sleep. That's what I'm talking about right now. It's a whole other issue to me if you start talking about living to be 400. And we have absolutely no idea if that's possible for humans. The worms, I have to say, you know, they live the equivalent. You can get them to live the equivalent of a 500-year lifespan staying young. So it can happen to an animal, but you're starting with a much shorter lifespan. It's not clear what is possible. But that is an issue. I mean, what if people could live to be 400 and still look young at the end of it? You know, that brings up a lot of other social issues. I think the good news about that is that I think it's probably likely to happen rather slowly. Do you know what I mean? If there were some kind of a pill or something that could do that. Probably it would be preceded by a lot of other pills that let you live just a little longer. So there should be lots of time for society to react to this, you know? But I mean, react it must, because that would be, you wouldn't get tenure at age 35 if you lived to be 400. I mean, that's very simple. You wouldn't retire. You wouldn't get Social Security at age 65 if you lived to be 400. So all these things would change. Not only that, you might be forced to get another job, because who wants someone to be in the same job for 400 years, you know? So that's the other question. You know, if you really had a lot of people, what about children? I mean, where is the room for the children? And that's very important. Now, this isn't to say that we wouldn't stop having wars and pestilences and things like that. We may still have a lot of death, even if you have a long natural lifespan. Maybe even more death. Who knows, you know? Society would respond to something like this, and you could get unusual responses.
Yeah, these are amazing prospects.
But yeah, and I think, you know, people don't really think about it now very much, except in science fiction, and that's probably right, because we have no idea if this is really ever going to be possible. But if it does look like it, then you'll start hearing more about this.
Well, there is also the sheer pragmatics of it, in the sense that, for example, as you know, Aubrey de Grey suggested that perhaps there were a series of technological fixes that would incrementally increase lifespan, so that, who knows, perhaps you could reach 1,000 or something like that. Whereas if you go and talk to David Sinclair about his work with sirtuins and so on, he will say, well, yeah, in principle, but in practice, actually even doing one of these tiny things that we're trying to do here is incredibly difficult. So imagining that entire cascade of positive, life-enhancing, life-elongating effects just seems unreal to me.
Well, I don't know. You know, people just, some other groups gave mice a compound called rapamycin, which inhibits TOR.
Right.
And the mice live
long. Is?
TOR is, yes, very important. TOR is a major nutrient sensor in the animal. TOR is a protein that's active if you have a lot to eat, and it helps you grow and process the food that you eat and so forth. If you're hungry, TOR levels fall, and you respond to that by making fewer proteins, by hunkering down, essentially. And inhibiting TOR can extend lifespan in yeast, in worms, in fruit flies, and now we know in mice. Rapamycin is a drug that inhibits TOR, and TOR is actually called target of rapamycin, that's T-O-R. So because knocking down TOR was so successful in increasing the lifespan of yeast and worms and flies, scientists started to try it on mice. And sure enough, it extended their lifespan. Now, rapamycin is a drug that's approved. We take it all the time. People take it to prevent rejection of organ transplants or transplanted organs by the immune system.
Right.
So there might be some dangers associated with taking rapamycin. It may give you a less effective immune system, but apparently in some ways the immune system is more effective. It's kind of a complicated situation. So it's not clear whether it's safe for people to take it, although there are people who have organ transplants who take it for the rest of their lives. But anyway, in mice, this drug extends lifespan. So we don't know yet whether resveratrol or sirtuins extend lifespan in a mouse. There's no demonstration of that yet. But there is for rapamycin, and there is for changing the insulin pathway I was talking about. You can get long-lived mice that way. So I think, at least in the case of rapamycin, we might already have a drug that would extend our lifespan. We don't know yet, but we might have it already. I don't know how much, but it could be close. It may not be, but it might be really close.
And the other sorts of issues were you talking about genetic manipulation?
Well, now that's what we do in animals. In animals, we change genes,
right,
and we look at the effect. For humans, instead of changing the gene, what you do is you make a drug that interacts with the protein that the gene encodes. And that way, while you're taking the drug, you either make the protein more active or less active. But then when you stop taking the drug, it goes back to normal, which is very good. I think that's the way to do it for something like aging, at least certainly at the beginning, because, you know, what if you get your dose off a little bit? You know, TOR is essential. The insulin pathway is essential. Some of these sirtuins are essential. If you completely knock them out, you could die, you know? And so you have to be really careful about that. So what you'd want is a pill where you could sort of titrate it in. You could get just the right amount, take a few tests, know it's the right amount, keep going.
One of the things that I was asking you earlier, what's one of the things that would help a wider audience understand more of this basic science, mm-hmm. so that they were able to make better informed decisions when an issue is brought to them, like the health bill and so on and so forth.
Oh my gosh.
That's a challenge. Mm-hmm. One thing, it seems to me, would be to sort of, for scientists to figure out some better way of naming all these little objects that they come up with. There's a total alphabet soup out there, isn't it? But do you have any thoughts about that? About how to communicate this kind of...
Well, I mean, I call the DAF2 gene the Grim Reaper, and DAF16 I call Sweet 16, because one kills you and one makes you live longer. So that's useful, I think. I don't know.
What does DAF stand for? Sorry.
It stands for actually something kind of, I told you that that these genes act during development. I didn't actually tell you this. I told you that if worms don't eat enough food when they're growing up, they'll arrest their growth and just wait for a while before they grow up. And the same genes that control aging, that act in the adult to control aging, act early in childhood to control entry into this state. And the state is called Dower. So the genes are called DAF, which stands for Dower Formation, D-A-F. Dower, the word Dower means enduring in German. So it's kind of like a state of hibernation, except it can only happen before puberty for the worm. So they got their names because of this other function that they have during childhood. And then we discovered later that they have a second function that they can carry out during adulthood. Yeah, but I think basically, let's see, a simple way to think about it, I guess just the idea of being resilient and being able to withstand the ravages of time, you know, that the body has this innate ability to do it. And if you can bring that out, coax it out of the individual, you know, then the individual will live longer. Now there may be, as Aubrey says, there may be additional things we can do. We may be able to come in with nails and hammers and, you know, change the body other ways. But I'm talking about what this kind of sort of magical, it's not magic, it's science, but it has this effect on you that a magical trick would have of letting the body do it itself just by tweaking a few genes, you know. That, I think, is the secret. That's something no one knew we had the capacity to do. No one knew that. You would think that you already lived as long as you possibly could. You know, if you could live longer, why not you already live longer,
right.
You know? And I gave you some possible explanations. I don't know the answer. But it looks like organisms have the capacity to do this.
Had you always intended to go into science? I mean, how did you get into science in the first place?
Well, I actually was really interested in understanding what I would call kind of truth, in a way, as a child, understanding myself and people. So I actually didn't know anything about science and started reading novels to try to understand more about myself and why I was the way I was and why I felt good sometimes and bad other times. I just thought the answers came from the classics, you know? And then I also liked animals, and so at one point I decided maybe I would be a veterinarian, and I learned a little about science, and then I liked science. And then I took a genetics course, and I learned that genes could get switched on and off, and amazing things could happen. You know, they were like little circuit boards, you know, and I thought, oh my God, look at that. So I got interested in it as a way, initially, of trying to understand myself, but, you know, kind of the level of moods and consciousness and happiness, things like that, that neuroscientists are studying. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of truncated, my search for understanding myself in that way, because I stopped before that and started studying essentially the basic biology of development, actually from a fertilized egg to an adult. And then I became interested in thinking, well, what happens after you're an adult? You know, you don't just stay there, you get older. So is there some kind of, you know, control over that process? And that's how I got into the aging process.
I remember seeing a piece about you and another your colleagues, Corey Bargman.
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, here we are, two women, absolute leaders in their field. And I read all the time about how difficult it still is for women to advance in science. I mean,
that's a really good question. What I did, I don't know, because I never thought of myself as a woman in science. Right. I thought of myself as a scientist. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the trick. And always what happens, what would happen would be, I would start to talk to someone, and they would realize pretty soon that, I think, that we were having an interesting conversation. And we would just get captivated by the ideas, and the conversation would become interesting, and we'd both be happy. And so I always imagine that if they had some kind of idea that I would be stupid because I was a woman, I don't know what I would think that they would think, but as soon as we started to talk, I just assumed all those thoughts would fly out the window and they would just be engaged in the science. And so I don't know if that's true or not, but I imagine it was true. And so I never really had much of a problem with being a woman. I do realize, yes, that there is discrimination, and I do try to do my part in helping to combat it, you know. But I still don't really like to think about it very much. And that's how I dealt with it. I don't know. I think each woman probably has her own answer to that. But that's what, you know, that's how I dealt with it. I just didn't think about it.
What was it like being in the orbit of Sydney Brenner?
Oh, it was wonderful. Sydney Brenner is amazing. And he's like, he is to me as I am to a dog mentally, I think. I mean, he has such an imaginative, quick, powerful brain. And it's just everything he says is interesting. The way he puts ideas together, the things he thinks about, his humor. It's marvelous, marvelous. You know, I'm always a little scared. I mean, I'm very intimidated by him. I hardly ever say anything. But fortunately, he likes to talk, so he may not even notice that. But fascinating to listen.
Yeah,
you know?
I know.
It's good.
And one thinks about the hundreds, thousands of people out there who are working on, have jobs and doing what they're doing precisely because of the initial work that he did.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Establishing
the Yeah, that is something. That's something, yes. Well, founding a company was like that for me and for other people who founded companies. I mean, you have an idea and you get people together to found a company, and suddenly all these people have jobs, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
This.
So tell me.
But with Sydney, it's really incredible.
Tell me about Elixir.
Well, I'm not actually with Elixir anymore.
Oh.
But what they did was decided to focus on mainly on a hormonal pathway called the ghrelin pathway. And it turns out ghrelin is a small hormone that's involved in feeding and appetite. And it turns out if you knock down the ghrelin signaling pathway a little bit, if you put mice on a high-fat diet, they're much healthier. Okay, they don't have this pre-diabetic syndrome. They're much healthier. It's a lot like the resveratrol syndrome. So that's what they're doing now. They have compounds now that inhibit this receptor, and they're now putting them into trials, or going down the road towards trials, for type 2 diabetes. And these compounds also affect insulin levels, so you never know, that might be an effect on lifespan, who knows. But that's the prime goal of the company right now. So I'm not part of the company, and in a way it's natural, because the company is now really focused on putting this one drug, you know, developing this one drug and putting it into trials.
I have seen several magazine cover stories or major articles recently about diabetes, about what now called metabolic syndrome. I mean, this is one of the fundamental issues involved in this whole longevity aging thing.
Yes, I have a very strong opinion about this. I think it's partly because kids are not eating their bacon and eggs in the morning. They're eating only carbs. That's one thing, I think. They eat bagels, cereal. They don't have protein and fat anymore. That's one thing. But another thing is they don't exercise. And I think what we should do is we should have mandatory exercise in schools. And many schools have cut down their PE programs because they don't have enough money. So I think you should have one of the two, or maybe both of the following systems. You could, every time, so students in high school, at least we used to go to one class, and then an hour later you go to another class. You get up, leave the room, go to another class, and sit down. So maybe the first 5 minutes of each class, instead of sitting down, you stand by your chair and you run in place, or you do jumping jacks, something really simple. Every teacher makes you do that. They have to do that. Or once, you know, that's all you, and that would do it. Honestly, just a little exercise once an hour for 5 minutes each time, there would be, the drop in obesity would be huge. A lot of it, these kids are sedentary. They sit with their computers, and they don't go outside, it's too dangerous, whatever. They eat all this sugar, and you could really, really combat a lot of it. Now, another thing you could do is you could make the teachers get together and decide on an exercise program. So teachers are people, you know, they would have children. Some of them ought to be able to figure out how to get the kids to exercise, even if they're not trained in PE. So you could say, okay, in order to get any funding, just make a law. They have to get together one way or another and figure out how to get their kids to exercise for one total hour a day. They could do what I just suggested, jumping jacks, or they could, I don't know, they could just figure it out. But I can tell you that it could be figured out. And if you make them do it, ordinary people, kids on their own, exercise, you know? So there are ways to do that without a PE program. You know, you don't need it. You can just, people can just do it.
One of the things that we've been doing on the Science Network is, in fact, building together a sort of a conceptual quilt where these various subject matters, we see the interrelationships between them and try and therefore bring these things together so that the Staying Alive meeting that we'll plan at some point, which is diet, nutrition, metabolism, and aging that I'm talking to you about, we've also talked to people about sleep. And we also have a meeting called Brains Are Us about the science of educating. And it's become clear as I've talked to various people that the sleep researchers have advice to give to the people who are in education, as you just gave advice to people who are in schools as well, about what to do metabolically.
Yeah.
So all of these things are intricately interconnected, it seems to me.
Yeah, they are. Exercise actually has really good anti-aging effects, too.
Well, as Rusty Gage would tell you, it's also
mentally, it's magical. Gyrus, you know. Actually, it's magical. It's just amazing, exercise, especially as you get older. I think it makes a huge difference.
And as you said, there was a story in USA Today on the cover less than a week ago in which they were saying because of budgetary cuts, that was the first thing to go in most schools.
Exactly. Well, right, so talk about saving money. You're going to have a whole school full of type 2 diabetics that are going to need to be propped up by the health system for the rest of their lives. It really, it's not very cost effective, you know, just one PE teacher. But you don't need a PE teacher. You could just do it. Ordinary people can do it.
If you had not been a scientist, is there anything else that you think you would have liked to have been?
Well, I have a kind of, I don't know, problem-solving sort of mind. I think an economist or someone who works on Wall Street or something like that. I think I'd like that. I like that. I think that would have been really interesting, just because I like to think about how the world works and money flows. It's not so much to make money as I just find it very interesting, and I think it's just a very interesting, you know, the ebb and flow of emotions and conditions, and if you just think about it holistically, you can place your bets. I think that would be a lot of fun.
That investigative stuff that started you off on all.
I think one thing about science I really like is that you are doing something that's good for the world. And I think if I were to go into some financial, probably would do is then have a foundation that funds science or something, you know, that does some good, because that's really important to me. You know, not just to make bets with your mind and be right, you know, but to do something good. I think that's important. But still be a lot of fun.
In his inaugural speech, President Obama, and just, this is something he repeated at a presentation of the National Academy of Sciences, he talked about restoring science.
Oh, I saw
science.
That. I was there, actually. I was in the audience
About restoring science to its rightful place.
Absolutely. It's very important.
So what is the rightful place of science?
Oh, I think it should be... it's a way of life, actually. Science is a way of looking at the world and gathering data through your senses and evaluating it and making predictions based on that data. It's reading about things and just making your own observations in a rational way. You know, it's knowing that if you flip a coin 10 times and it's heads every time, that the 11th time, the chance of getting heads is 50%, not zero. That's science. Do you see what I'm saying? It's the ability to think rationally about all sorts of things. And science also is a communal exploration of the unknown, okay? So that involves money, and it involves, you know, organization, laboratories, things like that. So I think science in everyday life should be a combination between just learning it and trying to you know, use it as be an inventor, you know, just start a company. Just, you know, think in a logical way, but maybe even become a scientist. So I think all those things, it's kind of the crown jewel, I think, of a developed country, really, of any country, is the ability to, you know, set aside some resources into exploring the unknown, you know, in order to understand it and to use it. You know, and also science is related to engineering, too. Engineering is not quite the same thing. Engineering is using knowledge to create new things that are beneficial. So making a pill that you could take to delay aging would be an engineering effort, whereas understanding aging is science. Okay, so they're related to one another in a nice way.
It seems to me that one of the things that, for whatever reason, general public seems to expect of science is certitude. Because if you then deliver certitude, then you have some information that you can work with and you can plan your life accordingly and so on and so forth. And science doesn't do certitude. But on the other hand, public doesn't understand probabilities very well.
I think they should be teaching that in elementary school.
Teaching what?
Probability, a little bit of coin flipping. I think that's really important to think in terms, and it's very important that we learn to do that as a society. You know, when you get your genes tested, you may have a slightly higher chance of getting a disease. Well, it matters if you have a 10 times higher chance or a 10% higher chance. That makes a big difference. For example, for all sorts of things. So it's important to be able to tell the difference, between tenfold and 10%, and to realize that there isn't any certain. People know that things aren't certain. You don't know if you're going to get cancer. I guess they might want to know, but they also might not want to know.
Well, but it's the way it's communicated. How is this stuff communicated? Because you can pick up a newspaper one day, and then 3 months later pick up another issue, and it says, sorry, that thing about the depression gene was not quite right.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that's very important to understand, which is that science is a process. The scientific inquiry is a process. And a scientist will do an experiment and get a result and publish the result, and the press often will pick it up. And sometimes the result doesn't stand the test of time, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. One possibility is that it was the temperature at which it was carried out, or the types of people who were studied. So sometimes there was nothing wrong with the study, really, but it just doesn't extrapolate well to other conditions or populations. Sometimes there are real problems with the study, just by accident, you know? Someone thought that the drug they were using was A when it was really B, because there was a mistake made in the company that shipped the drug to them. That can happen. So. The other thing is that there's such a desire for the knowledge that a lot of times this information gets out. People are hungry for information, so it gets out when really not all the experiments have been done. That's the case the way with aging right now. You know, we don't know if any drug will ever extend the lifespan of a human. We don't know. All we know is we know about these animals, and we know about these DNA variants in humans. And we also know that, you know, caloric restriction can do good things to your heart. We know that, but we don't know if it could do good things to your lifespan. So we know a little bit, but it's really premature to conclude that your children will be immortal or even live 10 years longer than you've lived. It's premature. We don't know. So there's a possibility, and people will just, you know, hope for it. So I don't know. You know, in other words, I think we're all culpable. There are problems at many levels. One problem is the nature of science itself. It's complex. The systems are complex. People are complex. So you do a simple experiment, and you find that you didn't know there was secondhand smoke. You thought the people who, maybe you thought if you smoked, the control population would be your wife who didn't smoke, or your brother who didn't smoke, who lived with you. You know. Then you find out there's secondhand smoke. There wasn't the right control. But we didn't know that. So there's that. And then there's the urge, the hunger for information, which draws it out of the scientific community prematurely. You know, the press is culpable too. Of course, the press wants to sell, and that's important too. So they'll hype it up. I mean, you know, when I give an interview, often the person who describes the interview says pretty much what I said, but the title is not made by the person who did it. It's made by whoever manufactures the journal, the magazine. So they'll say, she wants to be immortal. Well, I don't really know if I ever said that. Do you know what I'm saying? But that will be the title, not even put there by the person who did the interview, because it will sell magazines. So it would be nice if I don't know what to say about it. It's just the way of the world. As time goes on, we become more and more certain. We know that high cholesterol is bad for you. That's something that we really know now. We didn't, at one time we didn't, and now we do. So I think we will have more and more certainty about more and more things as time goes on. But it's just the nature of the beast. I mean, science is beautiful and wonderful in its own right, but it also promises to deliver to society a better life. And I think that both of them are important.
You have children?
I have a stepson.
Stepson, okay. Do you think about longevity in terms of personal relations and so on?
Quite honest, I think a lot more about things like global warming than I think about. I mean, when I really think about the life of, you know, my stepson and the future, I mean, there are a lot of really pressing issues that we have to solve as a planet that could, I mean, it's all well and good to talk about living this long, healthy life, but, you know, if the world ends, you know, a lot of good it did us. So, though there are really, 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 really important issues out there right now, that's one of them.
If you had an opportunity to sit down and have a conversation with anybody in history.
Benjamin Franklin.
Why?
And also, Benjamin Franklin would be one, and Leonardo da Vinci would be the other. Because they're very creative Renaissance people, you know? I think that would be, and Benjamin Franklin's very funny, so that would be, those would be my people.
Interesting choices.
Yeah.
Your early days searching for yourself, the exploration through novel reading.
So oh,
do
yes.
You still read avidly?
Or? Oh, I do, yeah. I read it a lot, yeah.
Well,
I'm reading Don Quixote right now, actually. I've never read it before, and it's the funniest book. I just love it. It's fabulous. It's so much fun. I mean, how did I ever get to be this old without reading it? But I'd never read it, and it's great.
Who's the smartest or the wisest person you know? Those are different things, by the way.
They are. Well, I don't know if I can answer the question about being the smartest person, because there's so many different ways to be smart. Bruce Alberts is a very wise person. He's in my department. He was the head of the National Academy of Sciences recently. I'm very impressed with our president, actually. And I think it's quite amazing, really amazing in many ways, yeah.
How would you characterize the current state of maturity of the field you're in?
It's a youngster. It's in its adolescent phase. It's a teenager. You know, we know there's something to study. Just every day, you open up the journal and you realize that a pathway that you discovered, or that was, you know, not necessarily I discovered, but that was thought to be one only operating in the worm, now operates in the mouse and the fruit fly and possibly humans. I mean, so this is just opening up at a very rapid rate. You know, we and other labs independently found that inhibiting the process of mitochondrial respiration, which makes ATP, which is the energy of the body, inhibiting that just a little can extend lifespan. And we were worried that it would be just a worm, quote, worm thing. But just last week, a paper came out saying that it also is the same in a fruit fly, and within the last year, it's been shown that it's the same in the mouse. And actually, I don't know if you know this, but there's this old idea that there were, among mammals anywhere, a fixed number of heartbeats, you know? Larger animals like elephants lived longer than smaller animals like dogs among the mammals. And they had a slower rate of metabolism, and so they had a slower heart rate. We're a little exceptional. We live long for our metabolic rapid heart rate. But just overall, if the mammals, there is this correlation. And it could be that that's because of, you know, this slower rate of respiration really is contributing to the long lifespan. It wouldn't be the only thing, but it could be doing it. The fact that it happens seems to be happening in all these species. And this is a whole mode of living longer that wasn't mentioned once in the talk today. It's a new way, relatively new. I mentioned it in my talk very slightly. I said a little bit about it, but not very much. but it could be a whole other pathway for longevity. So basically, like I said, we're just getting these amazing results very quickly, not in my lab only, but many labs together. And and some seem to conflict, and you know, and two labs will do the same experiment and get different results, and you don't know why, and you try to figure it out. And it's a very exciting time to be in the field, actually, because so much is new and startling, and it's not sure quite clear how it all fits together. I think you can tell if a field is young when you do an experiment and you get a surprise. You know, if you do an experiment and it always comes out pretty much the way you predict it, that's probably the time to move on to a new field. But in our field, you do an experiment and you're surprised a lot of the time. You know, so I really think that means that we don't really quite yet know, don't quite yet understand it.
Do you get asked often? I know that you give talks to sort of lay groups and so on. So I assume you must get asked all the time for your professional scientific advice about what people should do to live longer.
Oh, right. Well, the best thing you can do is to advise your congressman or woman to support scientific research. I'm serious. I'm conflicted. I have a conflict of interest. Some of that money might go to me. At the same time, the more people study this, the faster we'll have a real solution to it. You know, it's very simple. You know, it takes time and ingenuity and good luck, but the more people that are trying it, the faster it will go, and the more communication there is between the people. And so that is a huge thing anybody can do, you know, to learn a little more about it and write to their congressperson. The second thing, I don't know, you know, exercise, watch that sugar, you know.
These are things that are fairly generally known as well, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, I don't have any specific
Common
secret.
Sense.
I do like this low-carb diet, which comes in and out of fashion every 50 years or so. It's moving out of fashion now, but I think it's a really good thing.
Yeah,
but
this,
you know,
that's
me.
There again, there's something which is so baffling. You know, you that diet, and then you hear the Atkins diet, high protein, high fat, and so on.
Think of a Caesar salad. Visualize a Caesar salad. That's the quintessential good thing to eat. Lots of lettuce. Okay. Which has lots of carbohydrates that go into your bloodstream slowly, has a little cheese, has this nice dressing, which does not a very sweet dressing, and it has chicken or shrimp on top, shrimp or chicken Caesar salads. That's it. That's perfect.
It's not going to be low calories, though, is it?
No, it's not low calorie. But you eat less. And you don't store it as cholesterol. Your body, if the insulin isn't there, your body doesn't take the food and make a lot of cholesterol and store a lot of fat out of it. It uses it. It doesn't, you just don't eat as much, and you use what you eat. You don't store it as much.
There are two books with roughly the same title, one by Ramoni Cajal, mm-hmm. one by Peter Medawar.
Yeah.
They're both kind of roughly advice to a young scientist.
Yeah. And they're very good.
Do you have any?
I guess my advice is to figure out what you're good at and what you like. And sometimes you think you should do something that you are either don't like or you're not that good at. But you have to be successful, you should like it and you should be good at it. You know, you should have at least some ability to do it. And then just do it, you know. And don't let people, just stay away from pessimists too. Don't be one. And if you see them, try to steer clear of them, because I think they can bring you down. Just follow your dreams and work hard and go after what you want if you're good at it. You know, reasonably good at it. And then just try not to be, you know, distracted by all the negative things that you hear, because it'll just, like me, I have to stay away from people saying, you can't do that because you're a woman, you know, or whatever. Don't listen to that. Just don't. Or for whatever reason, because you're handicapped in some other way, you have this other problem, who knows what, or because any of a number of bad things will happen, you just have to not think about it. You just have to carry on, and you know, and if the easiest way to do that is to find what you love and go after that, because then everything will just fall into place. Your passions will guide you. You know, if you love discovery, which I do, you know, if you learn something new and you go, oh my God, I can't believe it, and it gives you this like this kind of a hit, you know, wow, that's just great. If you love that, and if you go for that or you know, surround yourself with the possibility of feeling that way, then you'll just be really happy and you'll just do it and you'll be successful. I mean, there are more specific things, like try to choose something where there's a lot of surprise, like I said, where, you know, you do an experiment, you often get a result you didn't expect. That means you're doing something that's worth doing. It's not already known. And also look around for things that aren't, where, you know, people just dismiss them as something boring, like the way they used to with aging. They thought, who would study aging? Ugh, you know. But there was a lot to study. A lot of people thought that about cancer and about Alzheimer's disease. In every case, when you start studying it, you realize it's actually really logical and very interesting and fascinating. So, you know, just have a second look at things.
You know? Is that how you lived your life so far?
It is. In terms of trying to figure out what I'm good at and do that and try to focus on that and not think too much about all the negative things that you could think about. And I go down the hall in the science. Often I'll come a little group of people and I'll stop to talk to them, and they're talking about, it's so hard to get a job, or this or that. And it's true, it's hard, and you have to be realistic, you know? I mean, there are things that you really shouldn't try to do, like Don Quixote, you know? There's certain things that you just can't do, no matter how much you think you can and want to, it's not gonna work. So you have to be a little bit realistic. But I think at the same time, you know, you do have to be a little, you just have to trust your instincts and, you know, let your, you know, them guide you a little bit.
Tilt at a few windmills.
I think so, yes, kind of an educated tilt.
Okay, last question. What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? In what sense? Do you mean scientifically, in terms of research on aging?
You choose.
I guess I'm optimistic about, I think about our state of happiness. I think that's gonna get better. I think we're learning more about it. We understand it better. We're learning more about how to have a happy life. I think we have, I'm optimistic that we'll have a good healthcare policy eventually, maybe not right away, but that we'll eventually get there. We should. It's embarrassing that we don't, and we should. I'm optimistic about, just my own life, you know.
See, there was a whole number of interconnected things there. That
about being able to find other books like Don Quixote, which I haven't read, which are fabulous. Yeah. Optimistic that this interview will end pretty soon and I can go have dinner.
We're through. Cynthia Kenyon, thank you very much.
Welcome.